Infinivox presents great science fiction stories. A Colder War by Charles Struss, read by Pat Botino. Analyst.
Roger Jorgensen tilts back in his chair, reading. He's in his mid-30s, fair hair razor-cropped, skin pallid from too much time spent under artificial lights. Spectacles, short sleeve, white shirt and tie, photographic ID badge on a chain around his neck. His office is air-conditioned and has no windows. The file he is reading frightens him. Once, when Roger was a young boy, his father took him to an open day at Nellis Air Force Base out in the California desert. Sunlight glared brilliantly from the polished silver plate flanks of the big bombers sitting in their concrete-lined dispersal bays behind barriers and blinking radiation monitors. The brightly colored streamers flying from their pitot tubes lent them a strange, almost festive appearance. But they were sleeping nightmares. Once they were awakened, nobody except the flight crew could come within a mile of the nuclear-powered bombers and live. Looking at the gleaming, bulging pods slung under their wingtip pylons, Roger had a premature inkling of the fires that waited within, a frigid terror that echoed the siren wail of the air raid warnings. He'd sucked nervously on his ice cream and gripped his father's hand tightly while the band ripped through a cheerful Sousa march, and only forgot his fear when a flock of thunder chiefs sliced by overhead, rattling car windows for miles around. He has the same feeling now as an adult reading this intelligence assessment that he had as a child watching the nuclear-powered bombers sleeping in their concrete beds. In the file, there's a blurry photograph of a concrete box, snapped from above by a high-flying U-2 during the autumn of 61. Three coffin-shaped lakes, bulking dark and gloomy beneath the Arctic sun, a canal heading west deep in the Soviet heartland, surrounded by warning trefoils and armed guards, deep waters saturated with calcium salts, concrete cofferdams lined with gold and lead, a sleeping giant pointed at NATO, more terrifying than any nuclear weapon. Project Koshki.
Red Square Redux.
Warning. The following briefing film is classified Secret Gold July Boojum. If you do not have Secret Gold July Boojum clearance, leave the auditorium now and report to your unit's security officer for debriefing. Failing to observe this notice is an imprisonable offense. You have 60 seconds to comply. Video clip. Red Square in springtime. The sky overhead is clear and blue. There is a little wispy cirrus at high altitude. It forms a brilliant backdrop for flight after flight of four-engine bombers, thundering five at a time across the horizon to drop behind the Kremlin's high walls. Voiceover.
Red Square, the May Day Parade, 1962. This is the first time that the Soviet Union has publicly displayed weapons classified Gold July Boojum. Here they are.
Video clip. Later in the same day, a seemingly endless stream of armor and soldiers marches across the square, turning the air gray with diesel fumes. The trucks roll in line eight abreast, with soldiers sitting erect in the back. Behind them rumble a battalion of T-56s, their commanders standing at attention in their cupolas saluting the stand. Jets race low and loud overhead, formations of MiG-17 fighters. Behind the tanks sprawl a formation of four low loaders, huge tractors towing low-slung trailers, their load beds strapped down under olive-drab tarpaulins. Whatever is under them is uneven, a bit like a loaf of bread the size of a small house. The trucks have an escort of jeep-like vehicles to either side. In the back of each, armed soldiers sit to attention. There are big five-pointed stars outlined in silver on each tarpaulin. Each star is surrounded by a stylized silver circle, unit insignia perhaps, but not in the standard format for Red Army units. There's lettering around the circles in a strangely stylized script. Voiceover.
These are live servitors under transient control. The vehicles towing them bear the insignia of the 2nd Guards Engineering Brigade, a penal construction unit based in Baccarat and used for structural engineering assignments relating to nuclear installations in the Ukraine and Azerbaijan. This is the first time that any Dresden Agreement party openly demonstrated ownership of this technology. In this instance, the conclusion we are intended to draw is that the 2nd Guards Engineering Brigade operates 4 units. Given existing figures for the Soviet Orbat, we can then extrapolate a total task strength of 288 servitors if this unit is typical.
Video clip. 5 huge Tu-95 Bear bombers thunder across the Moscow skies. Voiceover.
This conclusion is questionable. For example, in 1964, a total of 240 Bear bomber passes were made over the reviewing stand in front of the Lenin Mausoleum. However, at that time, technical reconnaissance assets verified that the Soviet Air Force had hard stand parking for only 160 of these aircraft. And estimates of airframe production based on photographs of the extent of the Tupolev Bureau's works indicate that total production to that date was between 60 and 180 bombers. Further analysis of photographic evidence from the 1964 parade suggests that a single group of 20 aircraft in 4 formations of 5 made repeated passes through the same airspace, the main arc of their circuit lying outside visual observation range of Moscow. This gave rise to the erroneous capacity report of 1964, in which the first strike delivery capability of the Soviet Union was overestimated by as much as 300%. We must therefore take anything that they show us in Red Square with a pinch of salt when preparing force estimates. Quite possibly, these 4 servitors are all they've got. Then again, the actual battalion strength may be considerably higher.
Still photographic sequence. From very high altitude, possibly in orbit, an eagle's eye view of a remote village in mountainous country, small huts huddled together beneath a craggy outcrop, goats graze nearby. In the second photograph, something has rolled through the village, leaving a trail of devastation. The path is quite unlike the trail of damage left by an artillery bombardment. Something roughly 4 meters wide has shaven the rocky plateau smooth, wearing it down as if with a terrible heat. A corner of a shack leans drunkenly, the other half sliced away cleanly. White bones gleam faintly in the track. No vultures descend to stab at the remains. Voiceover.
These images were taken very recently on successive orbital passes of a KH-11 satellite. They were timed precisely 89 minutes apart. This village was the home of a principal Mujahideen leader. Note the similar footprint to the payloads on the load beds of the trucks seen at the 1962 parade. These indicators were present, denoting the presence of servitor units in use by Soviet forces in Afghanistan. The 4-meter-wide gauge of the assimilation track, the total molecular breakdown of organic matter in the track, the speed of destruction. The event took less than 5,000 seconds to completion, no survivors were visible, and the causative agent had already been uplifted by the time of the second orbital pass. This, despite the residents of the community being armed with Dishka heavy machine guns, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and AK-47s. Lastly, there is no sign of the causative agent ever deviating from its course, but the entire area is depopulated. Except for excarnated residue, there is no sign of human habitation. In the presence of such unique indicators, we have no alternative but to conclude that the Soviet Union has violated the Dresden Agreement by deploying Gold July Bujum in a combat mode in the Khyber Pass. Without nuclear support, there are no grounds to believe that a NATO armored division would have fared any better than these Mujahideen.
Puzzle Palace.
Roger isn't a soldier. He's not much of a patriot either. He signed up with the CIA after college in the aftermath of the Church Commission hearings in the early 70s. The company was out of the assassination business, just a bureaucratic engine rolling out national security assessments. That was fine by Roger. Only now, 5 years later, he's no longer able to roll along, casually disengaged, like a car in neutral, bowling down a shallow incline toward his retirement, pension, and a gold watch. He puts the file down on his desk and, with a shaking hand, pulls an illicit cigarette from the pack he keeps in his drawer. He lights it and leans back for a moment to draw breath, force relaxation. He stares at the smoke roiling in the air beneath the merciless light until his hands stop shaking. Most people think spies are afraid of guns, or KGB guards, or barbed wire, but in point of fact, the most dangerous thing they face is paper. Papers carry secrets. Papers can carry death warrants. Papers like this one, this folio with its blurry 18-year-old faked missile photographs and estimates of time survivor curves and pervasive psychosis ratios, can give you nightmares, can drag you awake screaming in the early hours. It's one of a series of highly classified pieces of paper that he is summarizing for the eyes of the National Security Council and the president-elect, if his head of department and the deputy director CIA approve it, and here he is, having to calm his nerves with a cigarette before he turns the next page. After a few minutes, Roger's hand is still. He leaves his cigarette in the eagle-headed ashtray and picks up the intelligence report again. It's a summary, itself the distillation of thousands of pages and hundreds of photographs. It's barely 20 pages long. As of 1963, its date of preparation, the CIA knew very little about Project Koshki, just the bare skeleton, and rumors from a highly placed spy, and their own equivalent project, of course. Lacking the Soviet lead in that particular field, the USAF fielded the silver-plated white elephants of the NB-39 project, 12 atomic-powered bombers armed with XK Pluto, ready to tackle Project Koshki should the Soviets show signs of unsealing the bunker. 300 megatons of H-bombs pointed at a single target, and nobody was certain that would be enough to do the job. And then there was the hard-to-conceal fiasco in Antarctica. Egg on face. A subterranean nuclear test program in international territory. If nothing else, it had been enough to stop JFK running for a second term. The test program was a bad excuse, but it was far better than confessing what had really happened to the 501st Airborne Division on the cold plateau beyond Mount Erebus, the plateau that the public didn't know about, that didn't show up on the maps issued by the geological survey departments of those governments party to the Dresden Agreement of 1931, an arrangement that even Hitler had kept. The plateau that had swallowed more U-2 spy planes than the Soviet Union, more surface expeditions than darkest Africa. Shit, how the hell am I going to put this together for him? Roger spent the past 5 hours staring at this 20-page report, trying to think of a way of summarizing its dryly quantifiable terror in words that will give the reader power over them, the power to think the unthinkable. But it's proving difficult. The new man in the White House is a straight talker who demands straight answers. He's pious enough not to believe in the supernatural, confident that just to listen to one of his speeches is an uplifting experience. If you can close your eyes and believe in mourning in America, there is probably no way of explaining Project Koshki, or XK Pluto, or MK Nightmare, or the Gates, without watering them down into just another weapon system, which they are not. Weapons may have deadly or hideous effects, but they acquire moral character from the actions of those who use them, whereas these projects are indelibly stained by a patina of ancient evil. He hopes that if the balloon ever does go up, if the sirens wail, he and Andrea and Jason will be left behind to face the nuclear fire. It'll be a merciful death compared with what he suspects lurks out there, in the unexplored vastness beyond the gates, the vastness that made Nixon cancel the manned space program, leaving just the standing joke of the shuttle when he realized just how hideously dangerous the space race might become, the darkness that broke Jimmy Carter's faith and turned Lyndon B. Johnson into an alcoholic. He stands up, nervously shifts from one foot to the other, looks around at the walls of his cubicle. For a moment, the cigarette smoldering on the edge of his ashtray catches his attention. Wisps of blue-gray smoke coil like lazy dragons in the air above it, writhing in a strange cuneiform text. He blinks and they're gone, and the skin in the small of his back prickles as if someone had pissed on his grave. Shit! Finally a spoken word in the silence. His hand is shaking as he stubs the cigarette out. Mustn't let this get to me. He glances at the wall. It's 1900 hours. Too late, too late. He should go home. Andy will be worrying herself sick. In the end, it's all too much. He slides the thin folder into the safe behind his chair, turns the locking handle and spins the dial, then signs himself out of the reading room and submits to the usual exit search. During the 30-mile drive home, he spits out of the window, trying to rid his mouth of the taste of Auschwitz ashes.
Late night in the White House.
The colonel is febrile, jittering about the room with gung-ho enthusiasm. That was a mighty fine report you pulled together, Jorgensen. He paces over to the niche between the office filing cabinet and the wall, turns on the spot, paces back to the far side of his desk. You understand the fundamentals. I like that. A few more guys like you running the company, and we wouldn't have this fuck-up in Tehran. He grins contagiously. The colonel is a firestorm of enthusiasm, burning out of control like a 40s comic book hero. He has Roger on the edge of his chair, almost sitting at attention. Roger has to bite his tongue to remind himself not to call the colonel sir. He's a civilian, not in the chain of command. That's why I've asked Deputy Director McMurdo to reassign you to this office to work on my team as company liaison, and I'm pleased to say that he's agreed. Roger can't stop himself. To work here, sir? Here is in the basement of the executive office building, an extension hanging off the White House. Whoever the colonel is, he's got pull in positively magical quantities. What will I be doing, sir? You said your team. Relax a bit. Drink your coffee. The colonel paces back behind his desk, sits down. Roger sips cautiously at the brown sludge in the mug with the Marine Corps crest. The president told me to organize a team, the colonel says, so casually that Roger nearly chokes on his coffee, to handle contingencies. October surprises. Those asshole commies down in Nicaragua. We're eyeball to eyeball with an evil empire, Ollie, and we can't afford to blink. Those were his exact words. The evil empire uses dirty tricks, but nowadays we're better than they are. Bunch of hicks like some third world dictatorship. Upper Volta with Shagoths. My job is to pin them down and cut them up. Don't give them a chance to whack the shoe on the UN table, demand concessions. If they want to bluff, I'll call them on it. If they want to go toe-to-toe, I'll dance with them. He's up and pacing again. The company used to do that and do it okay back in the 50s and 60s, but too many bleeding hearts. It makes me sick. If you guys went back to wet ops today, you'd have journalists following you every time you went to the John in case it was newsworthy. Well, we aren't going to do it that way this time. It's a small team and the buck stops here. The colonel pauses, then glances at the ceiling. Well, maybe up there, but you get the picture. I need someone who knows the company, an insider who has clearance up the wazoo, who can go in and get the dope before it goes through a fucking committee of ass-watching bureaucrats. I'm also getting someone from the Puzzle Palace and some words to give me pull with Big Black. He glances at Roger sharply, and Roger nods. He's cleared for National Security Agency, Puzzle Palace Intelligence, and knows about Big Black, the National Reconnaissance Office, which is so secret that even its existence is still classified. Roger is impressed by this colonel, against his better judgment. Within the Byzantine world of the U.S. intelligence services, he is talking about building his very own pocket battleship and sailing it under the Jolly Roger with letters of marque and reprise signed by the president. But Roger still has some questions to ask to scope out the limits of what Colonel North is capable of. What about fever dreams, sir? The colonel puts his coffee cup down. I own it, he says bluntly, and Nightmare and Pluto. Any means necessary, he said, and I have an executive order with the ink still damp to prove it. Those projects aren't part of the national command structure anymore. Officially, they've been stood down from active status and are being considered for inclusion in the next round of arms reduction talks. They're not part of the deterrent ORBAT anymore. We're standardizing on just nuclear weapons. Unofficially, they're part of my group, and I will use them as necessary to contain and reduce the evil empire's war-making capabilities. Roger's skin crawls with an echo of that childhood terror. And the Dresden Agreement? Don't worry. Nothing short of them breaking it would lead me to do so. The colonel grins toothily. Which is where you come in.
The moonlit shores of Lake Vostok.
The metal pier is dry and cold. the temperature hovering close to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. It's oppressively dark in the cavern under the ice, and Roger shivers inside his multiple layers of insulation, shifts from foot to keep warm. He has to swallow to keep his ears clear, and he feels slightly dizzy from the pressure in the artificial bubble of air pumped under the icy ceiling to allow humans to exist here under the Ross Ice Shelf. They'll all spend more than a day sitting in depressurization chambers on the way back up to the surface. There is no sound from the waters lapping just below the edge of the pier. The floodlights vanish into the surface and keep going. The water in the subsurface Antarctic lake is incredibly clear, but are swallowed up rapidly, giving an impression of infinite inky depths. Manfred is here as the colonel's representative to observe the arrival of the probe, receive the consignment they're carrying, and report back that everything is running smoothly. The others try to ignore him, jittery at the presence of the man from D.C. There are a gaggle of engineers and artificers flown out via McMurdo Base to handle the midget sub's operations. A nervous lieutenant supervises a squad of Marines with complicated-looking weapons, half-gun and half-video camera, stationed at the corners of the raft. And there's the usual platform crew, deep-sea rig maintenance types, but subdued and nervous-looking. They're afloat in a bubble of pressurized air wedged against the underside of the Antarctic ice sheet. Below them stretch the still, super-cooled waters of Lake Vostok. They're waiting for a rendezvous. 500 yards, reports one of the techs. Rising on 10. His companion nods. They're waiting for the men in the midget sub, drilling quietly through 3 miles of frigid water, intruders in a long, drowned tomb. Have 'em back on board in no time. The sub has been away for nearly a day. It's set out with enough battery juice for the journey and enough air to keep the crew breathing for a long time if there's a system failure. But they've learned the hard way that fail-safe systems aren't. Not out here, at the edge of the human world. I was afraid the battery load on that cell you replaced would trip an under-voltage isolator and we'd be here till hell freezes over, the sub-driver jokes to his neighbor. Roger shuffles some more. Looking round, he sees one of the Marines cross himself. Have you heard anything from Gorman or Suslowitz? He asks quietly. The lieutenant checks his clipboard. Not since departure, sir, he says. We don't have comms with the sub while it's submerged, too small for ELF, and we don't want to alert anybody who might be, listening. Indeed. The yellow hunchback shape of the midget submarine appears at the edge of the radiance shed by the floodlights. Surface waters undulate oily as the sub rises. Crew transfer vehicle sighted, the driver mutters into his mic. He's suddenly very busy adjusting trim settings, blowing bottled air into ballast tanks, discussing ullage levels and blade count with his number two. The crane crew are busy too, running their long boom out over the lake. The sub's hatch is visible now, bobbing along the top of the water. The lieutenant is suddenly active. Jones, Savati, stake it out, left and center. The crane is already swinging the huge lifting hook over the sub, waiting to bring it aboard. I want eyeballs on the portholes before you crack this thing. It's the 10th run, 7th manned, through the eye of the needle on the lake bed, the drowned structure so like an ancient temple, and Roger has a bad feeling about it. We can't get away with this forever, he reasons. Sooner or later, the sub comes out of the water like a gigantic yellow bath toy, a cyborg whale designed by a god with a sense of humor. It takes 10 minutes to winch it in and maneuver it safely onto the platform. Marines take up position, shining torches in through 2 of the portholes that bulge myopically from the smooth curve of the sub's nose. Up on top, someone's talking into a handset plugged into the stubby conning tower. The hatch-locking wheel begins to turn. Gorman, sir! It's the lieutenant. In the light of the sodium floods, everything looks sallow and washed out. The soldier's face is the color of damp cardboard, slack with relief. Roger waits while the submariner Gorman clambers unsteadily down from the top deck. He's a tall, emaciated-looking man, wearing a red thermal suit 3 sizes too big for him. Salt and pepper stubble textures his jaw with sandpaper. Right now he looks like a cholera victim. Sallow skin, smell of acrid ketones as his body eats its own protein reserves, a more revolting miasma hovering over him. There's a slim aluminum briefcase chained to his left wrist, a bracelet of bruises darkening the skin above it. Roger steps forward. Sir? Gorman straightens up for a moment, almost a shadow of military attention. He's unable to sustain it. We made the pickup. Here's the QA sample. The rest is down below. You have the unlocking code? He asks wearily. Jorgensen nods. 1581229. Gorman slowly dials it into a combination lock on the briefcase, lets it fall open, and unthreads the chain from his wrist. Floodlights glisten on polythene bags stuffed with white powder, 5 kilos of high-grade heroin from the hills of Afghanistan. There's another quarter of a ton packed in boxes in the crew compartment. The lieutenant inspects it, closes the case, and passes it to Jorgensen. Delivery successful, sir. From the ruins on the high plateau of the Taklamakan Desert to American territory in Antarctica by way of a detour through gates linking alien worlds, gates that nobody knows how to create or destroy except the predecessors, and they aren't talking. What's it like through there? Roger demands, shoulders tense. What did you see? Up on top, Suslowitz is sitting in the sub's hatch, half slumping against the crane's attachment post. There's obviously something very wrong with him. Gorman shakes his head and looks away. The wan light makes the razor-sharp creases on his face stand out like the crackled and shattered surface of a Jovian moon. Crow's feet, wrinkles, signs of age, hair the color of moonlight. It took so long, he says, almost complaining. Sinks to his knees. All that time we've been gone. He leans against the side of the sub, a pale shadow, aged beyond his years. The sun was so bright, and our radiation detectors must have been a solar flare or something. He doubles over and retches at the edge of the platform. Roger looks at him for a long, thoughtful minute. Gorman is 25 and a fixer for Big Black, early history in the Green Berets. He was in rude good health 2 days ago when he set off through the gate to make the pickup. Roger glances at the lieutenant. I'd better go and tell the colonel, he says. A pause. Get these two back to recovery and see they're looked after. I don't expect we'll be sending any more crews through Victor Tango for a while. He turns and walks toward the lift shaft, hands clasped behind his back to keep them from shaking. Behind him, alien moonlight glimmers across the floor of Lake Vostok. 3 miles and untold light-years from home.
General LeMay would be proud.
Warning. The following briefing film is classified Secret Indigo March Snipe. If you do not have Secret Indigo March Snipe clearance, leave the auditorium now and report to your unit security officer for debriefing. Failing to observe this notice is an imprisonable offense. Video clip. Shot of huge bomber. Rounded gun turrets sprouting like mushrooms from the decaying log of its fuselage. Weirdly bulbous engine pods slung too far out toward each wingtip. 4 turbine tubes clumped around each atomic kernel. Voiceover.
The Convair B-39 Peacemaker is the most formidable weapon in our Strategic Air Command's arsenal for peace. Powered by 8 nuclear-heated Pratt & Whitney NP-4051 turbojets, it circles endlessly above the Arctic ice cap, waiting for the call. This is Item 1, the flight training and test bird. 12 other birds await criticality on the ground. For once launched, a B-39 can only be landed at the 2 airfields in Alaska that are equipped to handle them. This one's been airborne for 9 months so far and shows no signs of age.
Cut to... A shark, the size of a Boeing 727, falls away from the open bomb bay of the monster. Stubby delta wings slice through the air, propelled by a rocket bright glare. Voice over.
A modified Navajo missile, test article for an XK Pluto payload, dives away from a carrier plane. Unlike the real thing, this one carries no hydrogen bombs, no direct cycle fission ramjet to bring retaliatory destruction to the enemy. Traveling at Mach 3, the XK Pluto will overfly enemy territory, dropping megaton range bombs until, its payload exhausted, it seeks out and circles a final enemy. Once over the target, it will eject its reactor core and rain molten plutonium on the heads of the enemy. XK Pluto is a total weapon. Every aspect of its design, from the shockwave it creates as it hurtles along at treetop height to the structure of its atomic reactor, is designed to inflict damage.
Cut to Belsen postcards. Auschwitz movies. A holiday in hell. Voiceover.
This is why we need such a weapon. This is what it deters. The abominations first raised by the Third Reich's organization Tote, now removed to the Ukraine and deployed in the service of New Soviet Man, as our enemy calls himself.
Cut to a sinister gray concrete slab, the upper surface of a Mayan step pyramid built with East German cement, barbed wire, guns. A drain canal slashes north from the base of the pyramid toward the Baltic coastline, a relic of the installation process. This is where it came from. The slave barracks squat beside the pyramid like a horrible memorial to its black-uniformed builders. Cut to the new resting place. A big concrete monolith, surrounded by three concrete-lined lakes and a canal. It sits in the midst of a Ukraine landscape, flat as a pancake, that stretches forever in all directions. Voiceover.
This is Project Koshki. The Kremlin's key to the gates of hell.
Technology taster.
We know they first came here during the Precambrian Age. Professor Gould is busy with his viewgraphs, eyes down, trying not to pay too much attention to his audience. We have samples of macrofauna discovered by paleontologist Charles D. Walcott on his pioneering expeditions into the Canadian Rockies near the eastern border of British Columbia. A hand drawing of something indescribably weird appears on the screen, like this opabina which died there 640 million years ago. Fossils of soft-bodied animals that old are rare. The Burgess Shale deposits are the best record of the Precambrian fauna anyone has found to date. A skinny woman with big hair and bigger shoulder pads sniffs loudly. She has no truck with these antediluvian dates. Roger winces sympathy for the academic. He'd rather she wasn't here, but somehow she got wind of the famous paleontologist's visit, and she's the colonel's administrative assistant. Telling her to leave would be a career-limiting move. The important item to note, photograph of a mangled piece of rock, visual echoes of the opabina, is the tooth marks. We find them also, their exact cognates, on the ring segments of the Z-series specimens returned by the Pobody Antarctic Expedition of 1926. The world of the Precambrian was laid out differently from our own. Most of the land masses that today are separate continents were joined into one huge structure. Indeed, these samples were originally separated by only 2,000 miles or thereabouts, suggesting that they brought their own parasites with them. What do tooth marks tell us about them that we need to know? Asked the colonel. The doctor looks up. His eyes gleam. That something liked to eat them when they were fresh. There's a brief rattle of laughter. Something with jaws that open and close like the iris in your camera. Something we thought was extinct. Another viewgraph. This time with a blurry underwater photograph on it. The thing looks a bit like a bizarre fish, a turbocharged, armored hagfish with side skirts and spoilers, or maybe a squid with not enough tentacles. The upper head is a flattened disc, fronted by two weird fern-like tentacles drooping over the sucker mouth on its underside. This snapshot was taken in Lake Vostok last year. It should be dead. There's nothing there for it to eat. This, ladies and gentlemen, is Anomalocaris, our toothy chewer. He pauses for a moment. I'm very grateful to you for showing it to me, he adds, even though it's going to make a lot of my colleagues very angry. Is that a shy grin? The professor moves on rapidly, not giving Roger time to fathom his real reaction. Now this is interesting in the extreme, Gould comments. Whatever it looks like a cauliflower head, or maybe a brain, fractally branching stalks continuously diminishing in length and diameter until they turn into an iridescent fuzzy manifold wrapped around a central stem. The base of the stem is rooted to a barrel-shaped structure that stands on four stubby tentacles. We had somehow managed to cram Anomalocaris into our taxonomy, but this is something that has no precedent. It bears a striking resemblance to an enlarged body segment of Hallucigena. Here he shows another viewgraph, something like a stiletto-heeled centipede wearing a war bonnet of tentacles. But a year ago we worked out that we had poor Hallucigena upside down, and it was actually just a spiny worm. And the high levels of iridium and diamond in the head here, This isn't a living creature, at least not within the animal kingdom I've been studying for the past 30 years. There's no cellular structure at all. I asked one of my colleagues for help, and he was completely unable to isolate any DNA or RNA from it at all. It's more like a machine that displays biological levels of complexity. Can you put a date to it? The colonel asks. Yep, the professor grins. It predates the wave of atmospheric atomic testing that began in 1945. That's about all. We think it's from some time in the first half of this century or the latter half of the last. It's been dead for years, but there are older people still walking this earth. In contrast, he flips to the picture of an Amylocaris. This specimen we found in rocks that are roughly 610 million years old. He whips up another shot, similar structure, much clearer. Note how similar it is to the dead but not decomposed one. They're obviously still alive somewhere. He looks at the colonel, suddenly bashful and tongue-tied. Can I talk about the thing we were like earlier? Sure, go ahead. Everyone here is cleared for it. The colonel's casual wave takes in the big-haired secretary, and Roger and the two guys from Big Black, who are taking notes, and the very serious woman from the Secret Service, and even the balding, worried-looking admiral with the double chin and Coke bottle glasses. Oh, all right. Bashfulness falls away. Well, we've done some preliminary dissections on the Anamylocaris tissues you supplied us with, and we've sent some samples for laboratory analysis. Nothing anyone could deduce much from, he adds hastily. He straightens up. What we discovered is quite simple. These samples didn't originate in Earth's ecosystem. Cladistic analysis of their intracellular characteristics and what we've been able to work out of their biochemistry indicates not a point of divergence from our own ancestry, but the absence of any common ancestry at all. A cabbage has more in common with us than that creature. You can't tell by looking at the fossils, 600 million years after it died, but live tissue samples are something else. Item. It's a multicellular organism, but each cell appears to have multiple structures like nuclei, a thing called a syncytium. No DNA, it uses RNA with a couple of base pairs that don't occur in terrestrial biology. We haven't been able to figure out what most of its organelles do or what their terrestrial cognates would be, and it builds proteins using a couple of amino acids that we don't, that nothing does. Either it's descended from an ancestry that diverged from ours before the archaeobacteria, or, more probably, it is no relative at all. He isn't smiling anymore. The gateways, Colonel? Yeah, that's about the size of it. The critter you've got there was retrieved by one of our missions, on the other side of a gate. Gould nods. I don't suppose you could get me some more, he asks, hopefully. All missions are suspended pending an investigation into an accident we had earlier this year, the Colonel says, with a significant glance at Roger. Suslowitz died 2 weeks ago. Gorman is still disastrously sick, connective tissue rotting in his body, massive radiation exposure the probable cause. Normal service will not be resumed. The pipeline will remain empty until someone can figure out a way to make the deliveries without losing the crew. Roger inclines his head minutely. Oh, well, the professor shrugs. Let me know if you do. By the way, do you have anything approximating a fix on the other end of the gate? No, the colonel says. And this time Roger knows he's lying. Mission 4, before the colonel diverted their payload capacity to another purpose, planted a compact radio telescope in an empty courtyard in the city on the far side of the gate, XK Masada, where the air's too thin to breathe without oxygen, where the sky is indigo, and the buildings cast razor-sharp shadows across a rocky plain baked to the consistency of pottery under a blood-red sun. Subsequent analysis of pulsar signals recorded by the station confirmed that it was nearly 600 light-years closer to the galactic core, inward along the same spiral arm. There are glyphs on the alien buildings that resemble symbols seen in grainy black-and-white Minox photos of the doors of the bunker in the Ukraine, symbols behind which the subject of Project Koshki lies undead and sleeping. Something evil scraped from a nest in the drowned wreckage of a city on the Baltic floor. Why do you want to know where they came from? Well, we know so little about the context in which life evolves. For a moment, the professor looks wistful. We have had only one datum point, Earth, this world. Now we have a second, a fragment of a second. If we get a third, we can begin to ask deep questions, not like, is there life out there, because we know the answer to that one, now, but questions like, what sort of life is out there, and is there a place for us?
Roger shudders. Idiot, he thinks. If only you knew, you wouldn't be so happy. He restrains the urge to speak up. To do so would be another career-limiting move. More to the point, it might be a life expectancy-limiting move for the professor, who certainly doesn't deserve any such drastic punishment for his cooperation. Besides, Harvard professors visiting the executive office building in D.C. are harder to disappear than calm simp teachers in some fly-blown jungle village in Nicaragua. Somebody might notice. The colonel would be annoyed. Roger realizes that Professor Gould is staring at him.
Do you have a question for me? The distinguished paleontologist asks.
In a moment. Roger shakes himself, remembering time survivor curves, the captured Nazi medical atrocity records mapping the ability of a human brain to survive in close proximity to the Baltic singularity, Mengele's insanity, the SS's final attempt to liquidate the survivors, the witnesses. Koschke primed and pointed at the American heartland like a darkly evil gun, the world-eating mind, adrift in brilliant dreams of madness, estivating in the absence of its prey, dreaming of the minds of sapient beings, be they barrel-bodied, wing-flying, tentacular things, or their human inheritors. Do you think they could have been intelligent, Professor? Conscious, like us?
I'd say so. Gould's eyes glitter. This one, he points to a viewgraph, isn't alive as we know it, and this one, he's found a predecessor, God help him, barrel-bodied and bat-winged, had what looks like a lot of very complex ganglia, not a brain as we know it, but at least as massive as our own, and some specialized grasping adaptations that might be interpreted as facilitating tool use. Put the two together and you have a high-level technological civilization, gateways between planets orbiting different stars, alien flora, fauna, or whatever. I'd say an interstellar civilization isn't out of the picture, one that has been extinct for deep geological time, 10 times as long as the dinosaurs, but that has left relics that work.
His voice is trembling with emotion.
We humans, we've barely scratched the surface. The longest lasting of our relics? All our buildings will be dust in 20,000 years, even the pyramids. Neil Armstrong's footprints in the Sea of Tranquility will crumble under micro-meteoroid bombardment in a mere 500,000 years or so. The emptied oil fields will refill over 10 million years. Methane percolating up through the mantle. Continental drift will erase everything. But these people, they built to last. There's so much to learn from them. I wonder if we're worthy successors to their technological crown.
I'm sure we are, Professor, the Colonel's secretary says brassily. Isn't that right, Ollie? The Colonel nods, grinning. You betcha, Fawn. You betcha.
The Great Satan.
Roger sits in the bar in the King David Hotel, drinking from a tall glass of second-rate lemonade and sweating in spite of the air conditioning. He's dizzy and disoriented from jet lag. The gut cramps have only let him come down from his room in the past hour, and he has another 2 hours to go before he can try to place a call to Andrea. They had another blazing row before he flew out here. She doesn't understand why he keeps having to visit odd corners of the globe. She only knows that his son is growing up thinking a father is a voice that phones at odd times of day. Roger is mildly depressed, despite the buzz of doing business at this level. He spends a lot of time worrying about what will happen if they're found out, what Andrea will do, or Jason for that matter. Jason, whose father is a phone call away all the time, if Roger is led away in handcuffs beneath the glare of flashbulbs. If the colonel sings, if the shy, bald admiral is browbeaten into spilling the beans to Congress, who will look after them then? Roger has no illusions about what kills black operations. There are too many people in the loop. Too many elaborate front corporations and numbered bank accounts and shady Middle Eastern arms dealers. Sooner or later, someone will find a reason to talk, and Roger is in too deep. He isn't just the company liaison officer anymore. He's become the colonel's bagman, his shadow,
the guy with the diplomatic passport and the bulging briefcase full of heroin and end-user certificates. At least the ship will sink from the top down, he thinks. There are people very high up who want the colonel to succeed. When the shit hits the fan and is sprayed across the front page of the Washington Post, it will likely take down cabinet members and secretaries of state. The president himself will have to take the witness stand and deny everything. The republic will question itself. A hand descends on his shoulder, sharply cutting off his reverie. Howdy, Roger. What you worrying about now? Jorgensen looks up wearily. Stuff, he says gloomily. Have a seat. The redneck from the embassy, Mike Hamilton, some kind of junior attaché for embassy protocol by cover, pulls out a chair and crashes down on it like a friendly car wreck. He's not really a redneck, Roger knows. Rednecks don't come with doctorates in foreign relations from Yale, but he likes people to think he's a bumpkin when he wants to get something from them. He's early, Hamilton says, looking past Roger's ear, voice suddenly all business. Play the agenda. I'm your dim but friendly good cop. Got the background? Deniables ready? Roger nods, then glances around and sees Memo, family name unknown, approaching from the other side of the room. Memo is impeccably manicured and tailored, wearing a suit from Jermyn Street that cost more than Roger earns in a month. He has a neatly trimmed beard and mustache and talks with a pronounced English accent. Memo is a Turkish name, not Persian, false, of course. To look at him, you would think he was a westernized Turkish businessman, certainly not an Iranian revolutionary with heavy links to Hezbollah and, whisper this, old man Ruhollah himself, the hermit of Qum, never, ever in 1,000 years, the unofficial Iranian ambassador to the little Satan in Tel Aviv. Memo strides over. A brief exchange of pleasantries masks the essential formality of their meeting. He's early, a deliberate move to put them off balance. He's outnumbered, too, and that's also a move to put them on the defensive, because the first rule of diplomacy is never to put yourself in a negotiating situation where the other side can assert any kind of moral authority, and sheer weight of numbers is a powerful psychological tool. Roger, my dear fellow, he smiles at Jorgensen, and the charming Dr. Hamilton, I see. The smile broadens. I take it the good colonel is desirous of news of his friends. Jorgensen nods. That is indeed the case. Memo stops smiling. For a moment he looks 10 years older. I visited them, he says shortly. No, I was taken to see them. It is indeed grave, my friends. They are in the hands of very dangerous men, men who have nothing to lose and are filled with hatred. Roger speaks. There is a debt between us. Memo holds up a hand. Peace, my friend. We will come to that. These are men of violence, men who have seen their homes destroyed and families subjected to indignities, and their hearts are full of anger. It will take a large display of repentance, a high blood price, to buy their acquiescence. That is part of our law, you understand. The family of the bereaved may demand blood price of the transgressor, and how else might the world be? They see it in these terms, that you must repent of your evils and assist them in waging holy war against those who would defy the will of Allah. Roger sighs. We do what we can, he says. We're shipping them arms. We're fighting the Soviets every way we can without provoking the big one. What more do they want? The hostages, that's not playing well in D.C. There's got to be some give and take. If Hezbollah don't release them soon, they'll just convince everyone that they're not serious about negotiating. And that'll be an end to it. The colonel wants to help you, but he's got to have something to show the man at the top, right? Memo nods. You and I are men of the world and understand that this keeping of hostages is not rational, but they look to you for defense against the great Satan that assails them, and their blood burns with anger that your nation, for all its fine words, takes no action. The great Satan rampages in Afghanistan, taking whole villages by night, and what is done? The United States turns its back, and they are not the only ones who feel betrayed. Our Ba'athist foes from Iraq, in Basra, the unholy brotherhood of Takrit, and their servants, the Mukhabarat, hold nightly sacrifice upon the altar of Ya'ir Suthot. The fountains of blood in Tehran testify to their effect. If the richest, most powerful nation on earth refuses to fight these men of violence from the Bekaa, think, how may we unstopper the ears of that nation? And they are not sophisticates like you or I. He looks at Roger, who hunches his shoulders uneasily. We can't move against the Soviets openly. They must understand that it would be the end of far more than their little war. If the Taliban want American help against the Russians, it cannot be delivered openly.
It is not the Russians that we quarrel with, Memo says quietly, but their choice of allies. They believe themselves to be infidel atheists, but by their deeds they shall be known. The icy spoor of Leng is upon them. Their tools are those described in the Kitab al-Azif. We have proof that they have violated the terms of the Dresden Agreement. The accursed and unhallowed stalk the frozen passes of the Himalayas by night, taking all whose path they cross. And will you stop your ears even as the Russians grow in misplaced confidence, sure that their dominance of these forces of evil is complete?
The gates are opening everywhere, as was prophesied. Last week we flew an F-14C with a camera relay pod through one of them. The pilot and weapons operator are in paradise now. But we have glanced into hell, and have the film and radar plots to prove it. The Iranian ambassador fixes the redneck from the embassy with an icy gaze.
Tell your ambassador that we have opened preliminary discussions with Mossad, with a view to purchasing the produce of a factory at Dimona in the Negev Desert. Past insults may be set aside, for the present danger imperils all of us. They are receptive to our arguments, even if you are not. His Holiness the Ayatollah has declared in private that any warrior who carries a nuclear device into the abode of the Eater of Souls will certainly achieve paradise.
There will be an end to the followers of the ancient abominations on this earth, Dr. Hamilton, even if we have to push the nuclear bombs down their throats with our own hands.
Swimming pool.
Mr. Jorgensen, at what point did you become aware that the Iranian government was threatening to violate UN Resolution 216 and the Non-Proliferation Protocol of the 1956 Geneva Accords? Roger sweats under the hot lights. His heartbeat accelerates. I'm not sure I understand the question, sir. I asked you a direct question. Which part don't you understand? I'm going to repeat myself slowly. When did you realize that the Iranian government was threatening to violate Resolution 216 and the 1956 Geneva Accords on nuclear proliferation? Roger shakes his head. It's like a bad dream, unseen insects buzzing furiously around him. Sir, I had no direct dealings with the Iranian government. All I know is that I was asked to carry messages to and from a guy called Memo, who I was told knew something about our hostages in Beirut. My understanding is that the colonel has been conducting secret negotiations with this gentleman or his backers for some time, a couple of years now. Memo made allusions to parties in the Iranian administration, but I have no way of knowing if he was telling the truth, and I never saw any diplomatic credentials. There's an inquisition of dark-suited congressmen opposite him, like a jury of teachers sitting in judgment on an errant pupil. The trouble is, these teachers can put him in front of a judge and send him to prison for many years so that Jason really will grow up with a father who's only a voice on the telephone, a father who isn't around to take him to air shows or ball games or any of the other rituals of growing up. They're talking quietly to each other, deciding on another line of questioning. Roger shifts uneasily in his chair. This is a closed hearing. The television camera a gesture in the direction of the congressional archives. A pack of hungry Democrats have scented Republican blood in the water. The congressman in the middle looks toward Roger. Stop right there. Where did you know about this guy Memo from? Who told you to go see him, and who told you what he was? Roger swallows. I got a memo from Fawn, like always. Admiral Poindexter wanted a man on the spot to talk to this guy. A messenger, basically, who was already in the loop. Colonel North signed off on it and told me to charge the trip to his discretionary fund. That must have been the wrong thing to say, because two of the congressmen are leaning together and whispering in each other's ears. An aide obligingly sidles up to accept a note, then dashes away. I was told that Memo was a mediator, Roger adds, in trying to resolve the Beirut hostage thing. A mediator. The guy asking the questions looks at him in disbelief. The man to his left, who looks as old as the moon, thin white hair,
liver spots on his hooked nose, eyelids like sacks, chuckles appreciatively.
Yeah, like Hitler was a diplomat. One more territorial demand.
He glances around.
Nobody else remember that?
He asks, plaintively. No, sir, Roger says very seriously. The prime interrogator snorts,
What did Memo tell you Iran was going to do, exactly?
Roger thinks for a moment. He said they were going to buy something from a factory at Dimona. I understood this to be the Israeli Defense Ministry's Nuclear Weapons Research Institute, and the only logical item in the context of our discussion was a nuclear weapon, or weapons. He said the Ayatollah had decreed that a suicide bomber who took out the temple of Yag-Suthot in Basra would achieve paradise, and that they also had hard evidence that the Soviets have deployed certain illegal weapons systems in Afghanistan. This was in the context of discussing illegal weapons proliferation. He was very insistent about the Iraq thing.
What exactly are these weapon systems?
The third inquisitor demands. He's a quiet, hawk-faced man sitting on the left of the panel. The Shigadam, they're called. Servitors. There are several kinds of advanced robotic systems made out of molecular components. They can change shape, restructure material at the atomic level, act like corrosive acid or secrete diamonds. Some of them are like a tenuous mist, what Dr. Drexler at MIT calls a utility fog, while others are more like an oily globule. Apparently, they may be able to manufacture more of themselves, but they're not really alive in any meaning of the term that we're familiar with. They're programmable, like robots, using a command language deduced from recovered records of the forerunners who left them here. The Molotov raid of 1930 brought back a large consignment of them. All we have to go on are the scraps they missed and reports by the Antarctic Survey. Professor Liebkunst's files in particular are most frustrating.
Stop. So you're saying the Russians have these Shagaths, but we don't have any, and even those dumb Arab bastards in Baghdad are working on them. So you're saying we've got a Shagath gap, a chink in our strategic armor, and now the Iranians say the Russians are using them in Afghanistan?
Roger speaks rapidly. That is minimally correct, sir, although countervailing weapons have been developed to reduce the risk of a unilateral preemption escalating to an exchange of weakly godlike agencies. The congressman in the middle nods encouragingly. For the past 3 decades, the B-39 Peacemaker Force has been tasked by SIOP with maintaining an XK-Pluto capability directed at ablating the ability of the Russians to activate Project Koshki, the dormant alien entity they captured from the Nazis at the end of the last war. We have 12 Pluto-class atomic-powered cruise missiles pointed at that thing day and night, as many megatons as the entire Minuteman force. In principle, we will be able to blast it to pieces before it can be brought to full wakefulness and eat the minds of everyone within 200 miles. He warms to his subject. Secondly, we believe the Soviet control of Shagath technology is rudimentary at best. They know how to tell them to roll over an Afghan hill farmer village, but they can't manufacture more of them. Their utility as weapons is limited, though terrifying, but they're not much of a problem. A greater issue is the temple in Basra. This contains an operational gateway, and according to Memo, the Iraqi political secret police, the Mukhabarat, are trying to figure out how to manipulate it. They're trying to summon something through it. He seemed to be mostly afraid that they and the Russians would lose control of whatever it was, presumably another weakly godlike creature like the Cthulhu entity at the core of Project Koshki. The old guy speaks.
This Fulu thing, boy, you can drop those stupid K prefixes around me. Is it one of a kind?
Roger shakes his head.
I don't know, sir. We know the gateway's linked to at least 3 other planets. There may be many that we don't know of. We don't know how to create them or close them. All we can do is send people through or pile bricks in the opening.
He nearly bites his tongue because there are more than 3 worlds out there, and he's been to at least one of them. The bolt hole on XK Masada, built by the NRO from their secret budget. He's seen the mile-high dome Buckminster Fuller spent his last decade designing for them, the rings of Patriot air defense missiles, a squadron of black diamond-shaped fighters from the Skunk Works said to be invisible to radar, patrols the empty skies of XK Masada. Hydroponic farms and empty barracks and apartment blocks await the senators and congressmen and their families and thousands of support personnel. In the event of war, they'll be evacuated through the small gate that has been moved to the executive office building basement in a room beneath the swimming pool where Jack used to go skinny dipping with Marilyn. Off the record now, the old congressman waves his hand in a chopping gesture. I say off, boy. The cameraman switches off his machine and leaves. The old man leans forward toward Roger. What you're telling me is we've been waging a secret war since when? The end of the Second World War? Earlier? The Pobody Antarctic Expedition in the 20s, whose survivors brought back the first of these alien relics, and now the Iranians have gotten into the game and figure it's part of their fight with Saddam?
Sir, Roger barely trusts himself to do more than nod.
Well, the congressman eyes his neighbor sharply. Let me put it to you that you have heard the phrase, the great filter. What does it mean to you?
The great, Roger stops. Professor Gould, he thinks. We had a professor of paleontology lecture us, he explains. I think he mentioned it, something about why there aren't any aliens in flying saucers buzzing us the whole time. The congressman snorts. His neighbor starts and sits up.
Thanks to Pobody and his followers, Liebkunst and the like, we know there's a lot of life in the universe. The great filter boy is whatever force stops most of it developing intelligence and coming to visit. Something somehow kills intelligent species before they develop this kind of technology for themselves. How about meddling with relics of the Elder Ones? What do you think of that?
Roger licks his lips nervously. That sounds like a good possibility, sir, he says. His unease is building. The congressman's expression is intense.
These weapons your colonel is dicking around with make all our nukes look like a toy bow and arrow, and all you can say is it's a good possibility, sir. Seems to me like someone in the Oval Office has been asleep at the switch.
Sir, Executive Order 2047, issued January 1980, directed the armed forces to standardize on nuclear weapons to fill the mass destruction role. All other items were to be developmentally suspended, with surplus stocks allocated to the supervision of Admiral Poindexter's Joint Munitions Expenditure Committee, which Colonel North was detached to by the USMC High Command with the full cognizance of the White House. The door opens. The congressman looks around angrily.
I thought I said we weren't to be disturbed.
The aide standing there looks uncertain. Sir, there's been a major security incident and we need to evacuate.
Where? What happened? The congressman demands.
But Roger, with a sinking feeling, realizes that the aide isn't watching the House Committee members, and the guy behind him is Secret Service.
Basra, there's been an attack, sir.
A furtive glance at Roger as his brain freezes in denial. If you'd all please come this way.
Bombing in 15 minutes.
Heads down. Through a corridor where congressional staffers hurry about carrying papers, urgently calling one another. A cadre of dark-suited Secret Service agents closes in, hustling Roger along in the wake of the committee members. A wailing like tinnitus fills his ears. What's happening? He asks, but nobody answers. Down into the basement, another corridor, where two Marine guards are waiting with drawn weapons. The Secret Service guys are exchanging terse reports by radio. The committee men are hustled away along a narrow service tunnel. Roger is stalled by the entrance.
What's going on? He asks his minder.
Just a moment, sir.
More listening. These guys cock their heads to one side as they take instruction. Birds of prey scanning the horizon for prey.
Delta IV coming in.
Over.
You're clear to go along the tunnel now, sir.
This way.
What's happening? Roger demands, as he lets himself be hustled into the corridor, along to the end and around a sharp corner.
Numb shock takes hold, but he keeps putting one foot in front of the other.
We're now at DEFCON 1, sir. You're down on the special list as part of the House staff. Next door on the left, sir.
The queue in the dim-lit basement room is moving fast, white-gloved guards with clipboards checking off men and a few women in suits as one by one they step through a steel blast door and disappear from view.
Roger looks around in bewilderment.
He sees a familiar face.
Fawn, what's going on?
The secretary looks puzzled.
I don't know.
Roger, I thought you were testifying today.
So did I. They're at the door.
What else?
Ronnie was making a big speech in Helsinki. The colonel had me recorded in his office, something about not coexisting with the evil empire. He cracked some kind of joke about how we start bombing in 15 minutes. Then this, They're at the door. It opens on a steel-walled airlock, and the Marine Guard is taking their badges and hustling them inside. Two staff types and a middle-aged brigadier join them, and the door thumps shut. The background noise vanishes. Roger's ears pop. Then the inner door opens, and another Marine Guard waves them through into the receiving hall. "Where are we?" the big-haired secretary asks, staring around.
"Welcome to XK Masada," Roger says.
Then his childhood horrors catch up with him, and he goes in search of a toilet to throw up in.
"We need you back."
Roger spends the next week in a state of numb shock. His apartment here is like a small hotel room, a hotel with security, air conditioning, and windows that only open onto an interior atrium. He pays little attention to his surroundings. It's not as if he has a home to return to. Roger stops shaving, stops changing his socks, stops looking in mirrors or combing his hair. He smokes a lot, orders cheap bourbon from the commissary, and drinks himself into an amnesiac stupor each night. He is, frankly, a mess, self-destructive. Everything disintegrated under him at once. His job, the people he held in high regard, his family, his life. All the time he can't get one thing out of his head. The expression on Gorman's face as he stands there, in front of the submarine, rotting from the inside out with radiation sickness, dead and not yet knowing it. It's why he stopped looking in mirrors. On the fourth day, he slumped in a chair, watching taped I Love Lucy reruns on the boob tube, when the door to his suite opens quietly. Someone comes in. He doesn't look around until the colonel walks across the screen and unplugs the TV set at the wall, then sits down in the chair next to him. The colonel has bags of dark skin under his eyes. His jacket is rumpled, and his collar is unbuttoned.
"You've got to stop this, Roger," he says quietly. "You look like shit."
"Yeah, well, you too." The colonel passes him a slim manila folder. Without wanting to, Roger slides out the single sheet of paper within.
"So it was them."
"Yeah." A moment's silence. "For what it's worth, we haven't lost yet. We may yet pull your wife and son out alive, or be able to go back home. Your family, too, I suppose." Roger is touched by the colonel's consideration, the pious hope that Andrea and Jason will be all right, even through his shell of misery. He realizes his glass is empty. Instead of refilling it, he puts it down on the carpet beside his feet.
"Why?"
The colonel retrieves the sheet of paper from his numb fingers.
"Probably someone spotted you in the King David and traced you back to us. The Mukhabarat had agents everywhere. And if they were in league with the KGB? He shrugs. "Things escalated rapidly. Then the president cracked that joke over a hot mic that was supposed to be switched off.
Have you been checking in with the desk summaries this week?" Roger looks at him blankly.
"Should I?"
"Oh, things are still happening." The colonel leans back and stretches his feet out. "From what we can tell of the situation on the other side, not everyone's dead yet. Ligachev's screaming blue murder over the hotline, accusing us of genocide. But he's still talking. Europe is a mess, and nobody knows what's going on in the Middle East. Even the blackbirds aren't making it back out again. The thing at Tikrit,
yeah. It's bad news, Roger. We need you back."
"Bad news? The worst." The colonel jams his hands between his knees, stares at the floor like a bashful child. "Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti spent years trying to get his hands on elder technology. It looks like he finally succeeded in stabilizing the gate into Sutot. Whole villages disappeared. Marsh Arabs wiped out in the swamps of eastern Iraq. Reports of yellow rain. People's skin melting right off their bones. The Iranians got itchy and finally went nuclear. Trouble is, they did so 2 hours before that speech. Some asshole in Plotsk launched half the Uralskoye SS-20 grid they went to launch on warning 8 months ago, burning south, praise Jesus. Scratched the Middle East, period. Everything from the Nile to the Khyber Pass is toast. We're still waiting for the callback on Moscow, but SAC has put the whole peacemaker force on airborne alert. So far, we've lost the eastern seaboard as far south as North Virginia, and they've lost the Donbass Basin and Vladivostok. Things are a mess.
Nobody can even agree whether we're fighting the commies or something else. But the box at Chernobyl, Project Koshki, the doors are open, Roger. We orbited a keyhole 11 over it, and there are tracks leading west. The Pluto strike didn't stop it, and nobody knows what the fuck is going on in Warpack country, or France, or Germany, or Japan, or England. The colonel makes a grab for Roger's wild turkey, rubs the neck clean, and swallows from the bottle. He looks at Roger with a wild expression on his face. Koshki is loose, Roger. They fucking woke the thing, and now they can't control it. Can you believe that?
I can believe that. I want you back behind the desk tomorrow morning, Roger. We need to know what this Thulu creature is capable of. We need to know what to do to stop it. Forget Iraq. Iraq is a smoking hole in the map, but Cthulhu is heading toward the Atlantic coast. What are we going to do if it doesn't stop?
Masada.
The city of XK Masada sprouts like a vast mushroom, a mile-wide dome emerging from the top of a cold plateau on a dry planet in orbit round a dying star. The jagged black shapes of F-117s howl across the empty skies outside it at dusk and dawn, patrolling the threatening emptiness that stretches as far as the mind can imagine. Shadows move in the streets of the city, hollowed-out human shells in uniform. They rustle around the feet of the towering concrete blocks like the dry leaves of autumn, obsessively focused on the tasks that lend structure to their remaining days. Above them tower masts of steel, propping up the huge geodesic dome that arches across the sky, blocking out the hostile alien constellations, protecting frail humanity from the dust storms that periodically scour the bones of the ancient world. The gravity here is a little lighter, the night sky whirled and marbled by diaphanous sheets of gas blasted off the dying star that lights their days. During the long winter nights, a flurry of carbon dioxide snow dusts the surface of the dome, but the air is bone dry, the city slaking its thirst from subterranean aquifers. This planet was once alive. Near the equator there is still a scummy sea of algae that feeds oxygen into the atmosphere, and a range of volcanoes near the North Pole indicates plate tectonics in motion, but it is visibly dying. There is a lot of history here, but no future. Sometimes, in the early hours when he cannot sleep, Roger walks outside the city, along the edge of the dry plateau. Machines labor on behind him, keeping the city tenuously intact. He pays them little attention. There is talk of mounting an expedition to Earth one of these years to salvage whatever is left before the searing winds of time erases it forever. Roger doesn't like to think about that. He tries to avoid thinking about Earth as much as possible, except when he cannot sleep. Then he walks along the clifftop, prodding at memories of Andrea and Jason and his parents and sister and relatives and friends, each as painful as the socket of a missing tooth. He has a mouthful of emptiness, bitter and aching, out here on the edge of the plateau. Sometimes Roger thinks he's the last human being alive. He works in an office, feverishly trying to sort out what went wrong, and bodies move around him, talking, eating in the canteen, sometimes talking to him and waiting as if they expect dialogue. There are bodies here, men and some women chatting, civilian and some military, but no people. One of the bodies, an army surgeon, told him he's suffering from a common stress disorder called survivor's guilt. This may be so, Roger admits, but it doesn't change anything.
Soulless days follow sleepless nights into oblivion.
A narrow path runs along the side of the plateau, just downhill from the foundations of the city power plant, where huge apertures belch air warmed by the nuclear reactor's heat exchangers. Roger follows the path, gravel and sandy rock crunching under his worn shoes, dust trickling over the side of the cliff like sand into the undug graves of his family. Foreign stars twinkle overhead, forming unrecognizable patterns that tell him he's far from home. The trail drops away from the top of the plateau until the city is an unseen shadow looming above and behind his shoulder. To his right is a vertiginous panorama, the huge rift valley with its ancient city of the dead outstretched before him. Beyond it rise alien mountains, their peaks as high and airless as the dead volcanoes of Mars. About half a mile away from the dome, the trail circles an outcrop of rock and takes a downhill switchback. Roger stops at the bend and looks out across the desert at his feet. He sits down, leans against the rough cliff face, and stretches his legs across the path so that his feet dangle over nothingness. Far below him, the dead valley is furrowed with rectangular depressions. Once, millions of years ago, they might have been fields, but nothing of that survives. They're just dead, like everyone else on this world, like Roger. In his shirt pocket, a crumpled precious pack of cigarettes. He pulls a white cylinder out with shaking fingers, sniffs at it, then flicks his lighter under it. Scarcity has forced him to cut back. He coughs at the first lungful of stale smoke, a harsh, racking croak. The irony of being saved from lung cancer by a world war is not lost on him. He blows smoke out, a tenuous trail streaming across the cliff. "Why me?" he asks quietly. The emptiness takes its time answering. When it does, it speaks with the colonel's voice. "You know why." "I didn't want to do it," he hears himself saying. "I didn't want to leave them behind." The void laughs at him. There are miles of empty air beneath his dangling feet. "You had no choice." "Yes, I did." "I didn't have to come here," he pauses. "I didn't have to do anything," he says quietly, and inhales another lungful of death. "It was all automatic. Maybe it was inevitable." "Evitable," echoes the distant horizon. Something dark and angular skims across the stars like an echo of extinct pterosaurs. Turbofans whirring in its belly, the F-117 hunts on, patrolling to keep the ancient evil at bay, unaware that the battle is already lost. "Your family could still be alive, you know," he looks up. "They could? Andrea? Jason? Alive?" The void laughs again, unfriendly. "There is life eternal within the Eater of Souls. Nobody is ever forgotten or allowed to rest in peace. They populate the simulation spaces of its mind, exploring all the possible alternative endings to their lives. There is a fate worse than death, you know." Roger looks at his cigarette disbelievingly, throws it far out into the night sky above the plain. He watches it fall until its ember is no longer visible. Then he gets up. For a long moment he stands poised on the edge of the cliff, nerving himself and thinking. Then he takes a step back, turns, and slowly makes his way back up the trail toward the redoubt on the plateau. If his analysis of the situation is wrong, at least he is still alive. And if he is right, dying would be no escape. He wonders why hell is so cold at this time of year.
This has been an Audio Text production. Production copyright 2005. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening to Great Science Fiction Stories. Visit our website at www.audiotexttapes.net. Other titles in this series include Lobsters by Charles Stross, The Territory by Bradley Denton, House of Bones by Robert Silverberg, Solstice by James Patrick Kelly, Rammer by Larry Niven, A Walk in the Sun by Jeffrey A. Landis, Under Siege by George R. R. Martin, Schrodinger's Kitten by George Alec Effinger, Cilia of Gold by Stephen Baxter, Blood Sisters by Greg Egan, and Slow Birds by Ian Watson.